WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The last time Congo exploded in violence, civil war ravaged the country for 5 years, dragging six other African nations into the conflict and claiming the lives of 3.5 million people. Last year, the warring factions in what came to be known as the African World War reached a tenuous peace, but recent unrest in the country's mineral-rich eastern region now threatens to escalate into full-blown war, drawing Congo's neighboring nations into yet another bloody, costly conflict. The international community is getting uneasy, and earlier this week, US and British envoys paid Congo an emergency visit to try to quell the violence. Tonight on Point, bloodshed in Congo and the US role in maintaining the peace. We begin in Kigali, the capital of Congo's neighbor Rwanda, where freelance reporter Duncan Woodside has been covering the story for the Christian Science Monitor. For the past several weeks, Woodside has been in Bukavu, the town in eastern Congo where last month's fighting first broke out. I asked him where things now stood following the latest round of violence.
Things are at the moment in a very tense situation because the Rwandan government has not responded at all kindly to the movement by Kinshasa in terms of the troops to the Congo-Rwanda border. Rwanda sees it as an aggressive action, and they have said that if Congo were to probe at all, then they would not be hesitant in responding with a military force. So things are still very tense. However, there has been a degree of de-escalation, and the international community is working very hard to ensure that these two powers remain reasonably peaceful towards each other, because there are at the moment delegations which have been sent by both the UK and also America as well to Kinshasa and Kigali, which are the respective capitals of Congo and Rwanda. And much movement has been going on between those two capitals in the last couple of days. I know that the UK Minister for Africa, who is Chris Mullin, who I spoke to a few minutes ago after a presidential conference, he said, or he at least implied, that the British government had used the threat to withhold financial assistance from Rwanda. Now, this is a very significant potential threat that the UK government has, because it is the biggest bilateral donor to Rwanda in the whole world. So all these factors, the fact that the British government and the US government are applying pressure to the administrations in Kigali and Kinshasa, point towards a de-escalation over the coming days.
Why does Congo look upon Rwanda as such a threat?
Because Rwanda has been involved in eastern Congo twice in the last 8 years. They invaded in late 1996 and again in 1998. Now, Rwanda's rationale for this was that they were chasing down remnants of the Hutu militia who were responsible for the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. So that is a legitimate rationale on the part of Rwanda. And even now, this is a major concern of theirs, because these militia groups remain domiciled in the east of Congo, and the Rwandan government continues to point towards them as a threat. And this is underscored by the fact that in April there was an incursion into Rwandese territory by one of these militia groups.
And all this happening at a time when the Congo is trying to hold elections next year.
Indeed they are. How far that schedule is realistic now is open to question, because over the last few weeks, the troubles in the east of Congo have shown that significant divisions still exist within the transitional administration. And for these difficulties to be solved, it may well mean that the transitional period has to go on longer than previously envisaged.
You talk of a transitional government, a transitional period. Is this process being overseen by the international community?
Very much so. The international community has a significant presence within DR Congo. There are 10,800 UN troops. In fact, it is the UN's most expensive peacekeeping operation in the world at the moment. And there is a big commitment on the part of the international community to ensuring that there is a peaceful transition after the civil war ended in 2003. Much is made of the fact that 3 million people died between 1998 and 2003 in Congo, which is effectively equivalent to a World Trade Center every 1.5 days for 5 solid years. So there is a very big commitment at the highest levels, I think, to ensuring that DR Congo remains on a path towards eventual peace and democracy.
And of course, it's not just Rwanda that has an interest in Congo. There are a number of other African countries in the region who were drawn in to the last civil war.
That is very true. There were six countries aside from DR Congo which were involved in the 1998-2003 conflict. A lot of this stems from the fact that Eastern Congo is very rich in natural resources, which include coltan, diamonds, copper, and also methane gas reserves. So when the situation becomes more volatile in that area, when the government is in a position where it appears to be losing control, there is a strong incentive for other powers to become involved in the area and exploit these natural resources in a non-legal manner.
Now, it's obviously important for the people of Congo itself that security, stability should return to the country. But how important is it for the region as a whole?
I think that the region as a whole does have a significant vested interest in the long term to ensure that there is peace and democracy in Congo. Obviously, nation states sometimes have a short-term incentive to become involved in a disruptive manner, but if there is to be economic progress and trade and also continued Western investment, which is obviously massively important for the development of the region, then I feel that cooperation and peace is the only long-term solution for these countries. And one would hope that the key players, the leaders of these nation states, are taking this into account during the current crisis.
You mentioned in passing that getting on for 11,000 UN troops are currently deployed in Congo. Is there a feeling that more are needed if the country is to remain stable until the holding of elections next year?
There is a feeling in some quarters that more troops are needed. I do know that it is being discussed within the UN at the moment as to whether a further force, a rapid reaction force, should be deployed as a means of offsetting any threat of a further or a renewed escalation in the fighting there.
And presumably this continued instability in Congo has prompted movements of the population, created a new refugee problem as well.
Indeed, that is the case. So far, there have been around 35,000 refugees registered on the Burundian side of the border with Congo. And also in late May and early June, around 3,000 made their way across into Rwanda. That was before Rwanda closed its border with Congo, or officially closed its border with Congo, because of the movements in Kinshasa, the words in Kinshasa, as to the effect that the Rwandan government had backed the rebels, which had caused the latest instability. The Rwandan government decided to take the step of closing the border until these accusations had been dropped.
Duncan Woodside, thanks.
Good to speak to you today.
And Duncan Woodside is a freelance reporter who's been covering the conflict in Congo for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to me from Kigali in Rwanda. We're talking tonight about violence brewing in Congo. Do you know what's happening in Congo? Does it matter to you? Why should the US care about what happens in Central Africa? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now in the studio is John Shattuck, former US Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labour in the Clinton administration, and the leader of a 2003 human rights delegation to Congo. He's also the author of a forthcoming book, Freedom on Fire, Human Rights Wars and America's Response. Welcome, John Shattuck.
Thank you.
Also joining us from Washington, D.C. is Mvemba Pezo-Dizulele, a foreign policy analyst and journalist and a native of Congo. Welcome, Mvemba Dizulele.
Thank you, John.
Could I just turn to you first? The origins of the current cycle of violence might be said to stem back to the 1996 genocide in Rwanda, but the chronic instability in Congo, what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo, go back even further than that. Tell me more.
Well, if we want to go back, we should start with the 32 years of Mobutu's rule of Congo. So for 32 years, Mobutu ruled Congo in a dictatorial way. But there was not that kind of instability as we've seen since 1996, meaning he had an iron fist on the country, so he was actually able to secure the country across the borders. The current situation, the current crisis as we know it, dates back from 1994. After the Rwandan genocide, Zaire opened its border to all the refugees who were running away from Rwanda. Some of the refugees were the former military personnel of the Rwandan army, which was known at the time as the Forces Armées Rwandaises. When they came to camp, they brought their weapons with them. that's when they started posing a threat to the current government, the Tutsi government in Rwanda. The Rwandans ask for the UN community to disarm these refugees because it's unacceptable to have weapons in refugee camps. The international community failed to do that, namely the UNHCR. Then the Rwandan asked Mobutu to do the same. Mobutu failed. And that provided the Rwandan for the incentive or the pretext to go into Congo to try to deal with this threat in eastern Congo.
So national grievances have contributed towards fueling this conflict.
Yes, very much so. But beyond these national grievances, I think those are actually more artificial. I think they've been more of a strategic goals or political goals on the part, especially on the part of Rwanda and Uganda, that have clashed with the security in the region.
John Chattuck, when you were in Congo last year, there were high hopes, weren't there, that this cycle of violence could be brought to an end?
Yes, last year I think the crisis was a little bit on the downswing, and it's now very much on the upswing again. And I think the roots of the conflict are just as has been described. Certainly the long Mobutu rule and the Rwandan genocide in 1994. By the time 2003 came, there was a peace process that was underway that was led by South Africa and that the United Nations was very much involved in, which was in the process of trying to develop a transitional government that would get the warring parties to stop their fighting. That was extremely difficult for reasons that have just been described, involving Rwanda and Uganda having strong interests in trying to promote their own security and, to some extent, their own interests and control over the eastern Congo. So the peace process has always been very tenuous. And now, as a result of things that happened just a month ago, it is in the process of being tested even more because of violence in the East.
United States backed President Mobutu for decades during the period of the Cold War. Is there still a commitment by Washington to stability in Congo?
Well, I wish I could say there was more of a commitment. I certainly have been one, a voice who's been trying to get more of a commitment from the United States to address crises like the one in Rwanda that led to the crisis in the Congo. I think the United States has many interests there. This certainly is the case that we should be more engaged. We have an economic interest. We certainly have security interests in an age of terrorism, and the prospect of terrorists being harbored in failed states is ever present. And certainly we have a moral interest as a result of the Rwandan genocide.
And Mvemba Dzulele, the United Nations currently is running one of their biggest peacekeeping operations in the world in the Democratic Republic of Congo, nearly 11,000 troops. What more, in your opinion, should be done?
I think for a start, the UN need to clarify what kind of mandate they're given the mission in the Congo. MONUC is the name of the mission. So far, MONUC has been a failure. They have 10,000 troops, 10,800 or so troops. They spent, they have a yearly budget of $608 million a year. The way we understand it on the outside from all the readings is that they have a full Chapter 7 mandate, which means they can enforce peace. They can fire and they can interfere when troops are invading the civilians or molesting civilians. So far, MONUC has failed to do that, which has generated a sense of impunity in the region where various militias don't even listen to what MONUC says. So what I would recommend is either MONUC lives up to his full mandate, the Chapter 7 mandate, or they actually get out of the way. So maybe intervention force that is more capable will be able to come in and patrol the corridor, the eastern corridor that has been the challenge, the source of the challenge between Rwanda and Congo.
Mvemba Dzulele, do stay with us, and you too, John Chattuck. We're talking tonight about violence in Congo and the United States. Does the U.S. have a responsibility to prevent another round of fighting in Central Africa? What time is the right time for America to get involved? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about tensions escalating in Congo and the U.S. role in preventing more bloodshed. Can we afford to get involved in yet another international conflict? Can we afford not to? Do you care? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to John Shattuck, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State in the Clinton administration and the leader of a 2003 humanitarian delegation to Congo. Also with us is Mvemba Pezo-Dizolele, a foreign policy analyst based in D.C. and a NATO of Congo. Mvemba Dizolele, in arguing for greater international interest, greater international intervention possibly in the Democratic Republic of Congo, you are competing with a lot of other conflict zones in the world, and particularly in Africa at the moment. I'm thinking here of the Darfur region of Western Sudan, where more than 1 million people have been displaced. The Congo is not yet on that scale.
Well, we hope that Congo will never reach that scale. But without forgetting that Congo is, you know, in the genocide in Rwanda, 800,000 people died. Tremendous catastrophe. In Congo, for the last 5 years, like your correspondent so eloquently put it, more than 3.5 million people have died, meaning more than four times the number of people died in Rwanda. So we're already at that level. We cannot afford to add to that number. So Congo is competing with some operations, but I think what is lacking in Congo is that it's the will of countries like the U.S., countries like the U.K., to back the process. Congo has traveled a long way from 98 when they had the so-called First World War to today with a transitional government in Kinshasa. What they need, you know, the Africans have done the part, meaning South Africa, Zambia, all these countries that brokered the peace that we're knowing now, need a hand. They need a support now from the international community so that Congo can see this process to fruition.
John Shattuck, how does the United States decide when and how to get involved in conflicts such as the one in Congo?
Well, the decision process is anything but a steady one, but I think that particularly when it comes to a very far-off crisis that seems to have no direct security implications for the United States. So what will often happen is those who begin to analyze the crisis in terms of the United States' interests will press hard for American involvement. And I think that has been going on in the case of the Congo for some years now. But with all of the attention being diverted by the war on terrorism in Iraq, the voices of those who are showing what the U.S. interests are have not been as strong as they should be. And this administration in particular, I think, has paid very little attention. But we have security interests. We have an interest in the stability of the region. We have an interest in preventing it from turning into a haven for terrorists. We have an interest in the economic resources, along with the rest of the international community, and having a regular access to those resources and not plunder of those resources so that the people of the Congo can benefit. And we certainly have an interest in preventing another genocide like the one that occurred and was so tragic in Rwanda, which was so enormously expensive, not only, but especially, of course, in the case of 800,000 lives lost, but in the case of the billions of dollars of humanitarian assistance that flowed into Rwanda, which nonetheless led to the kind of instability that's taking place in Congo and the tragic ongoing civil war. So we have an interest in engaging, and there are very specific things that the United States could do, which I'd be happy to outline for you.
Okay, well, let's hear about those in a minute. But let me just ask Mvemba Pezo-Dizolele whether this is really more of a conflict to be sorted out by regional organizations. After all, part of the problem here is you've got countries like Rwanda, Uganda, Angola, who were involved in the last war, continuing to meddle in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Isn't this something for the African Union?
I do agree with you in that Congo is not being left alone to deal with its problem. This is a process that has started since 1960, at the wake of the independence. So Congolese never had a chance to deal with the internal affairs in family, as you will say. So it is true that today, with the meddling of Rwanda and Uganda and other countries, the Congolese have not got any room to breathe. So what we're calling for, specifically on the part of the international community, is to weigh heavily on countries like Uganda or Rwanda to let the Congolese sort their problems. Because once Congo is back on its feet, Rwanda will have peace. Uganda will have peace. Congo is the size of Western Europe. It borders 9 countries. When Congo is on its knees, the region is on knees. When Congo is on its feet, the region on its feet.
Okay, well, let's bring in Roger. He's calling from Boston, and he wants to make a particular point to contribute to this conversation. Roger, what do you want to say?
Yes, I would like to say that the Congolese people are very disappointed about the position of the United States vis-a-vis the Congo. There's been a lot of people in Congo itself who have been fighting Mobutu for almost 33 years, and those people, they never get any support from the United States. And quite surprisingly, we see those rebel people who came, and suddenly they get support from the United States, and the United States put them in power there in the Congo. The actual government that is in Congo is a group of gangsters who are killing Congolese people. Those people, they have to be brought to justice. Kabila himself, Mbemba, Robespierre, all those people that are vice president or president, they have to be brought to justice, because what's going on in Congo actually is really unacceptable. There have been political party like UDPS for Etienne Tshisekedi, who have been fighting Mobutu for 33 years. This guy, he's for a democracy, but he never get any support from the United States. And at the same time, United States, he's preaching around the world the democracy, but he doesn't want to support the people who are fighting for the democracy in Africa. He's continuing supporting dictatorship in Africa, especially in Uganda.
Okay, well, let's get a reaction from Vemba Pezzo-Dizzolelli to that. And the point that Roger was making is that an awful lot of those in political power in Congo at the moment have got blood on their hands.
That's correct. I will agree with Roger. And I think this is an opportunity for the international community or countries like the U.S. The Congolese people embrace the same values that we do in the U.S. They want democracy. They want to live in peace. They want an accountable government. Because a lot of the people, some of the people in the transitional government have blood on their hands, this is an opportunity for the international community to say, we're going to crank it up. You have to redeem yourself. This is your chance, at least to show us that you're worth being in this society. If you don't deliver, we will prosecute you. And I think this is a chance that the international community should seize on.
John Shattuck, there was an additional point I think that Roger was making just then, namely that the United States does have considerable influence with countries like Uganda and Rwanda, and could exert influence on them to be more restrained, not to intervene, not to meddle in the Congo.
Well, that's exactly the kind of approach that I think the United States should be taking, that is to put pressure on both Uganda and Rwanda not to overdo their efforts to protect their own security by imposing and indeed supporting guerrilla movements in the eastern part of the Congo, which is in fact one of the main sources of instability. The United States has enormous ability to work with other countries to put that kind of pressure on, particularly with European countries who are main donors. And sadly, I have to say, and our report documents this, the U.S., at least until very recently, has not been engaging with Rwanda and Uganda in the way they should. When I was in the Congo, there was an arms embargo on Rwanda that was lifted by the United States at the very time when it should have been reimposed.
Okay, I'd like to pause now to welcome into the conversation Judith Registre, the director of the Congo chapter of Women for Women International, an organization that helps women reintegrate into society in post-conflict countries. Judith was in Bukavu when fighting broke out there last month and was later evacuated. She'll return to Congo next month. Welcome, Judith Registre.
Thank you.
We've been talking about Congo in terms of the geostrategic overturns to the conflict, but you've seen for yourself the results of the fighting there and the impact that it's had on the local people.
Yeah, and I think thank you for bringing us into this conversation. As my colleague have mentioned, the number of the estimated 3.3 million people who have died as a result of the conflict, many of that death has been due as a result of disease and other, preventable measures.
Now, that was 3.5 million in the last conflict, but in the latest fighting, you've had a chance to see how that's affecting local people in Bukavu in the eastern Congo.
Well, the latest conflict, I think, you know, what has been described in terms of what the population has suffered. For the first 3 days in June during the conflict, the communities had the most outrageous attack on them. Women were raped day to day for 3 days. They were going from communities to communities, door to doors. When they come in contact with any woman, the first thing was to rape them, pillage the household. If the father was there, the son was there, that son was asked to participate. If that son was unwilling to participate in that process, that individual was tied and watched while the mother or the sister was raped. One of the most devastating aspects of the war is the impact it has on the population and the type of suffering that the women in DRC are experiencing. When we talk about rape, it comprises individual rape, sexual abuse, gang rape, mutilation of genitalia, rape shooting, rape stabbing. Sometimes families are forced not only to watch but to participate. The communities are forced to watch and participate. So when you talk about the community being disintegrated as a result of the conflict, it goes beyond the loss of family members. It's the impact that the community is having to deal with as a result of the military, and that includes everyone from all sides of the conflict. On that part, no one is innocent.
Okay, the full horrors of war there in eastern Congo from Judith Registra, the director of the Congo chapter of Women for Women International. Many thanks. Let's just bring in Benjamin calling from Boston. Benjamin?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for taking my call. The comment I'd like to make is that somebody started by saying that Congo has never been left alone by herself, and it's exactly true. The West is responsible for what is going on in Congo. They have been responsible for what is going on in Congo, for the fact that the rebels are well-armed and being financed by somebody else, and Kigali in Rwanda should be put on check. That guy is responsible for what is going on there. He's being used by the West to grab the Bukavu area, which is rich in mineral resources. And that is all they're fighting for. They're trying to get a hand in that rich mineral resources so they can use it to their own benefit and to the detriment of the area. Thank you.
John Chaddock, what evidence is there that governments such as Uganda, Rwanda are being used as proxies by the United States to gain access to Congo's mineral wealth?
Well, there was a report. First of all, I'm not sure that that there is evidence that they're being used by governments as proxies, but I think there's certainly evidence that they are being used by interests, economic interests, some of them based in Europe, some of them based in the United States. There was a United Nations study done last year, the UN report on the illegal exploitation of national resources in the Congo. And it concluded that certainly the diamonds, the coltan, the gold, the wide variety of extraordinary natural resources that Congo has, particularly in the eastern area, has been a source of a tremendous international intrigue for many years, as the weak government in the Congo has been unable to protect those resources. And I think that is underlying a lot of the interest that is being shown by the neighbors in trying to stimulate further conflict and to have their own particular surrogates going in there to assist them in extracting these mineral resources.
And then, Mbembe Dzulele, Congo is now, in fact, has been ever since independence, a victim of its own mineral resources and potential wealth.
That is correct. You know, we've come to believe that that's a curse. But, you know, minerals aside, people are really tired of this last 40 years of living in a gray area where you're not really fully enjoying your own life. So the Congolese people are really launching SOS out there to the world and saying, you know, we've put in a lot. In one year time, we're supposed to have the elections. Please help us see this through. We have a transitional government that is making as much effort they can. Please put pressure on them. Please help us. Let's work together on finally making Congo shine.
Andrea's calling from Washington, D.C., and she wants to join the conversation, asking the question, if you like, the other way around. Andrea?
Yes, basically, I was wondering, how does the United States benefit by not getting involved? I understand that both Rwanda and Uganda have been utilizing resources from the Congo and selling those to U.S. and international companies, and I just would like somebody to speak on that issue.
John Shattuck?
Well, that is indeed one of the sources of the conflict, as we've just been saying. And I think your caller is right to ask the question in the reverse, which is why should the United States not become involved in the sense that we do have significant interest in the stability of the region? We also have moral interests in the human rights catastrophe that's been unfolding now for many years, starting with the Rwanda genocide. And I think it's, frankly, the diversion of other activities that the United States is engaged in. And I also fear that some of the way in which the U.S. is projecting its power in other parts of the world is significantly reducing its credibility and its ability to lead the kind of coalitions that ought to be led in the context of
conflict in Rwanda. Is there even a debate going on within the State Department as to whether or not the United States should get involved?
Well, after I did my report and came back, I went to the National Security Council and the State Department trying to meet at high levels with people to present them the evidence that I had that this was a conflict that needed much more attention by the United States. And I was very sad to find that there wasn't a great deal of interest at high levels. I certainly spoke with the desk officers and the assistant secretary, but by no means anybody of a higher rank. And, you know, I think, again, the focus on Iraq, on the war on terrorism, all of the other things that are happening in the United States government that right now have put it in under significant stress and prevented it from looking at crises of equal magnitude in Africa, particularly Congo and Sudan, which I think could very well be sources of international instability that could affect our security directly.
And Mbembe Pezo Dzulele, arguably the United States is already involved by endorsing the UN Security Council decision to deploy UN troops to the Congo. Isn't that enough?
No, that's not enough. Congo, it's not just a question of UN security or UN troops being on Congo. I mean, this is a political issue that needs to be solved on the political front first and foremost. Rwanda and Uganda depend heavily from the United States. They depend heavily on the United States for the financial help, for the financial assistance, for the military. The U.S. has a lot to bring to the table, a lot of leverage that they can use on those countries. They have a lot of leverage they can use on Congo. Congo has 40 years of relationship, meaning the Congolese people and the American people have 40 years of relationship. Congo was important during the Cold War and is still important today for the same reasons.
Okay, Mbembe,
it holds Central Africa together.
Stay with us. We will continue the conversation. And you too, John Shattuck. We're discussing the current conflict in Congo and whether the United States should get involved. What's your standard for U.S. involvement in international conflict? Should we nip fighting in the bud or wait until the first dust has settled? Is it ever too late to intervene? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the conflict in eastern Congo and what the U.S. role should be. Do you follow what happens in Africa? President Clinton has said he regrets not acting to prevent the 1994 Rwanda genocide. Do you agree he made a mistake? Could the bloodshed in Congo escalate into a tragedy on a comparable scale? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to John Shattuck, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State in the Clinton administration and Congo watcher. Also with us is Mbembe Pezo Dzulele, a native of Congo and foreign policy analyst currently based in Washington, D.C. And let's take a call now from Patrick in Boston. Patrick, what did you want to say?
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I think the issue I'm trying to point here is that there's a lot of blame going on, blaming the countries of Rwanda and Uganda. And the legitimate interests of security for these countries doesn't seem to be coming up, because all I'm hearing is these countries have gone in Congo because of the mineral resources. Yes, I may agree that there may have been some individuals in the army that have got some, that have interests in, they may have even dealt in these minerals and all this, But there are some security, legitimate security issues for Uganda. For example, I come from the town of Fort Portal, which is almost at the border of Congo and Uganda. And I've seen schools being burnt. I've even lost relatives because of the rebel groups that have been harbored in the Congo. And our country, Uganda, has had to go into the Congo for that reason. But those issues are not being brought up. All I'm hearing is that they've gone in for minerals. Unless that issue of stabilizing Congo so that we don't have rebel groups in those countries coming in Uganda. And the same thing with Rwanda. The problem cannot be solved.
Okay. Mbembe Pezo Dizulele, Uganda, Rwanda have legitimate security concerns, and these haven't been addressed up until now by the government in Kinshasa.
Well, let's step back. In 1994, when Rwanda started launching its claims against Congo because of security, that's a legitimate question. What happened in the last 7 years? Rwanda and Uganda came into Congo. Rwanda and Uganda came to Congo because they wanted security. For 7 years, what did we see? There is no single record in history where you can document any battle between the Rwandan army and the Interahamwe. Rwanda has been in Congo for 7 years. Instead of chasing those Interahamwe and the so-called rebel groups, Rwanda find themselves in the rainforests of Middle Zaire at the time. They find themselves in Kinshasa, which is 2,000 miles from the border where the insecurity is supposed to take place. If Rwanda has a claim, then let us see them fighting these rebels. I don't have any recollection historically where Rwanda had any battle with these rebels. What I do recall is Rwanda and Uganda fighting in Kisangani, which is north of the region that they're talking about, over mine. There have been at least three incidents when the armies of Rwanda and Uganda went at each other. That's not solving a security issue. It's been 7 years. If they failed, it's their own problem.
Alex calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and you have a question for John Shattuck.
I do. My question is, what will it take to motivate U.S. lawmakers, U.S. Interests, to take an involvement in the Congo? We know the reasons why we went to war in Iraq. What will it take to motivate domestic politicians to do the same in the Congo?
Well, I don't think the level of involvement that we now have in Iraq is what we're looking for in the Congo, and certainly the kind of instability that has resulted in Iraq in large measure from the kind of involvement that we have is something we would not want to wish on the Congo. But I do think a very different level and kind of engagement is necessary. I think the United States should lead an international coalition working with other countries, particularly European countries who are donors in the region, to put the kind of diplomatic pressure on the parties, including Uganda and Rwanda, but also on those individuals who are trying to run the transitional government in the Congo.
Mr. Shattuck is a member of an administration that saw it coming in Rwanda, the 1994 genocide, and yet held back.
Yeah.
I mean, what has to happen in an African country for the U.S. to get engaged?
Well, I think the catastrophe that of U.S. non-engagement and European non-engagement in the Rwanda genocide will rank as one of the gravest failures of international security around the subject of human rights for a long time. What the tragedy, at least in terms of U.S. non-involvement there, was that the U.S. had been burned in another African country, in Somalia, very shortly before, where it had lost a number of U.S. peacekeepers and a U.N. force, and that led to a political reaction against the engagement in Rwanda. And right now, I think, the tide is running the other way in the sense that the U.S. is certainly engaged in other countries like Iraq. But what's needed, I think, is a much more level-headed approach toward involving U.S. diplomatic and economic resources to try to put pressure for the end of the conflict rather than necessarily a full-scale military intervention.
And Mbembe Pezo Dizulele, we've been talking about why the United States should become more involved. We've asked why the United States is not involved. What are the consequences, though, of Washington not becoming more engaged? And not just Washington, the rest of the international community as Congo approaches those critical elections next year.
Well, I think John Chadwick has actually addressed some of the issue very eloquently, but I'll add that, again, Congo is the heart of Africa, of Central Africa, nine neighboring countries, all of them depending on their security based on what's going on in the Congo. If Congo is on its knees, the debacle is just going to be, I don't know how we can describe what can happen when Congo falls onto its knees. Congo cannot disintegrate, and it will not disintegrate because there's such a strong national identity in the country. What we can do is help Congo get back on its feet, because Congo is as important as South Africa is in the south, as Nigeria is in the west, as Egypt is in the north. This will be the test for the Bush administration to show that they're actually very, very serious about engaging Africa.
Okay, Dan's calling from Boxford, Massachusetts, and he wants to touch on a point that I raised earlier. Dan?
Yeah, I came into the program at 7:30, so I might have missed it. But I wanted to know what was the role of the UN in the conflict in Congo. Why is it the United States' responsibility and not the entire world's responsibility?
Because John Chadwick?
Well, the role of the UN, I think, to some extent, has been a very effective one, even though the peacekeeping has not lived up to the promise we'd like to see. And I think it is exactly an indication of why the UN is so important to the United States. We're talking here about U.S. interests in Africa and particularly in the Congo. And I think the U.S. needs to do more to strengthen the United Nations in what it's trying to do in the Congo, including, if necessary, increasing the size of the peacekeeping force, including perhaps contributing more itself to that force, not necessarily through troops, but logistics and other forms of supply. And the United Nations is no more and no less than the major countries that make up its commitments. And the United States in this case, frankly, has not had the level of commitment that has allowed the United Nations to do the job that it should be doing in the Congo. Nonetheless, I think it's been a reasonably good UN operation.
And Mvemba Pezo-Dezulele, do you feel the same?
Not really. I do commend the role that the UN has played, and like John Chadwick says, the UN is only as strong as its members. If we go back a few minutes ago where we're talking about the illegal exploitation of resources, the UN expert panel, which was led by Mahmoud Kassem last fall, found out that there were all these countries that were involved. Instead of putting the report, giving full access to the report to the entire world, the Security Council classified that information. Now, that is the wrong message. The part of the problem with the Congo is impunity. Impunity at the local level, impunity with international involvement. By classifying that message, that report, the message is we want to protect the guilty. And we cannot be involved in that kind of way. The message should be clear. We are behind the Congolese people. We're going to support you in your transition. We're going to start with the justice.
Mvemba Pezo-Dezulele, a native of Congo and foreign policy analyst currently based in Washington, D.C. Many thanks for being with us. And my thanks to you too, John Chadwick, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labor in the Clinton Administration, also author of a forthcoming book, Freedom on Fire, Human Rights Wars and America's Response. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a call to reopen the 40-year-old Mississippi burning murder cases. This is On Point. Forty years ago this week, three civil rights activists, James Chaney, Michael Schwerner, and Andrew Goodman, were murdered in Philadelphia, Mississippi. They were investigating a church firebombing when they were lynched by the Ku Klux Klan, allegedly with the aid of the local sheriff. The murders captured the attention of President Lyndon Johnson, who sent the FBI in to investigate, and became a key moment in the civil rights struggle. But the state of Mississippi never brought murder charges against the 19 accused. The murder and its aftermath were chronicled in the 1988 film, Mississippi Burning.
The reason people don't want to talk to you is because they're afraid it'll get back to the law.
We are the law.
Not around here, you ain't.
We were sent here to find out what happened to those three boys. They were here to help you.
It ain't colored folks you should be talking to.
Ben Chaney is the brother of James Chaney, one of the three murder victims. 40 years after the lynching, he's pushing to have his brother's murder case reopened. He says he's found a federal prosecutor willing to prosecute the case and says the Attorney General of Mississippi is paying attention. In this radio diary, Ben Chaney recalls what happened the night of June the 21st, 1964, and explains why he thinks it's important to reopen the four-decade-old murder case.
My brother had identified a church in Longdale, Mississippi, a part of Philadelphia, Mississippi, where it could be used as a freedom school where African Americans could be taught their constitutional rights to vote. The church was destroyed one night on June 16, 1964. So my brother and Mickey Swan and Andrew Goodman went back to investigate the damage that was done to the church. The parishioners was beaten by the Klan, and the church was burnt down. They went back to talk to the parishioners and try to convince them to file a complaint with the Justice Department. The sheriff deputy of Neshoba County arrested James, Andy, and Mickey, locked them up in jail about 4 p.m. that afternoon on Father's Day, June 21, 1964, and held them until they could get a pan posse together. Once the posse was put together, by 10 p.m. that night, they released them from jail. The deputy sheriff then arrested them again and turned them over to the Ku Klux Klan, where they were murdered and buried in a man-made dam for 44 days before their bodies were found. Justice needs to be done. There needs to be closure in the matter. You know, everybody's life has value, and the state of Mississippi is duty-bound to prosecute murderers. And they know who the murderers are. There were three confessions made from the murderers. Evidence is overwhelming, and yet the state of Mississippi refused at this point to seriously move forward. We demand justice for James, Andy, and Mickey. They deserve justice just like anybody else deserves justice. I was 11 years old when the murders occurred, and I remember the great sadness that fell upon my family, particularly my mother, when she discovered that my brother was missing. Even though I had hoped that nothing would happen to him, I really believed that he was indestructible because he was my older brother. My mother knew better. Being raised in Mississippi, living there all of her life, she had other family members have disappeared and were lynched by the Klan, so she knew better. She knew that he was not coming back, and I remember the great sadness that was upon her, and I really hope that in her lifetime, before she passes on, she can realize that her son's death, one, was not in vain, that other young people are moving forward, and two, that the state of Mississippi valued his life by prosecuting the murder.
We heard there from Ben Chaney, the brother of civil rights activist James Chaney, who was murdered 40 years ago Monday. He spoke to us from Memphis, Tennessee. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.